Welcome to Gastric Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Peter Enzinger, and to begin, we talked about some of the key research data sets presented at the ASCO meeting in June, beginning with an important phase 3 trial comparing two perioperative chemotherapy regimens.
I think that that probably was the most important study that was presented at ASCO this year. It arguably, and I think for most of us, has changed the standard of care. It's based on Sala Albitran's work in metastatic disease, where he has taken the AIO regimen, which is 24-hour 5-FU and leucovorin, plus oxaliplatin that they've developed. So it's the German version of FOLFOX and added docetaxel to that regimen. So FLOT is actually 5-FU, leucovorin, oxaliplatin, and docetaxel. The regimen has shown promise in the metastatic disease setting and obviously now has been moved into the adjuvant setting. For years now, since David Cunningham's publication in the New Journal of Medicine in 2006, the MAGIC study, that had been the standard of care for many of us, giving 3 cycles of ECF before and after a gastrectomy. This study now looks at ECF or ECX, I think it was investigator's choice, versus the FLOT regimen. And I must say, the improvement in disease-free survival, overall survival, is truly impressive. There are significant improvements in both parameters, hazard ratios that are highly significant. The toxicity is not a freebie. FLOT clearly is toxic, and I think that many of us are now going to learn the intricacies and toxicities of this regimen. And it's quite clear that there will be substantial toxicity with this regimen, and this should be given probably only to the strongest and healthiest patients. But the difference in toxicity versus ECF, ECX is not that great. When you look at serious adverse events, I think it was 61% in one arm, 62% in the other arm. So very similar toxicity. There's certainly more nausea and vomiting with an epirubicin-based regimen. Otherwise, there was more neuropathy with docetaxel, more, I think, infections and some fatigue. So I think that ultimately it's going to be a new standard of care for patients of good performance status. It had, I think, 430-something patients. This was conducted entirely in Germany. There was some people talking about how German patients were more hardy than patients of other countries, but I think we're going to very quickly learn if this is doable or not in our American and other European patients.
So yeah, the median overall survival was 35 months with ECF, ECX, and 50 months with FLOT, hazard ratio 0.77, p-value significant. 3-year survival, 48% versus 57% with FLOT. Also, progression-free survival is improved with the FLOT regimen, 30 months versus 18 months. So are you actually using this regimen in your practice?
Honestly, I've not. I don't have any firsthand experience yet. You know, back in the day, well, back in the day is probably 5-6 years ago, you know, there'd be a new regimen that would come out and we would immediately just handwrite the new regimen in and start giving it. In this day and age where we have pathways and we have computer builds, in our particular case, it's called a beacon build, sort of pivoting is not as quick anymore. I have to get approval from various pharmacy committees, and I have to get the computerized system to build the new regimen. So we had not been using it for metastatic disease, and so it's going to take us a few weeks to build this for the adjuvant setting.
It kind of sounds like maybe, is this going to be maybe similar to FOLFIRINOX and pancreatic cancer?
I think so, yeah. I think we're all a little worried about the toxicity, but I suspect in the end it's going to be tolerated well enough that most of our patients, particularly at academic centers where we have sort of the better performance status, younger patients, are going to be able to tolerate it. We'll see how the older patients do with this.
So getting back to ASCO, like a lot of solid cancers and hematologic cancers now, the continuing big story has been checkpoint inhibitors. A lot of room, I think, for optimism, and certainly in terms of gastric cancer. I want to ask you about a couple of big papers. Your colleague, Charlie Fuchs, presented the KEYNOTE-059 study, the cohort one of pembrolizumab monotherapy. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely.
And in light of the monotherapy checkpoint data in general?
Absolutely. Well, our institution was the largest contributor to that study, so we actually have a lot of firsthand experience with the patients on that trial. What I will say is that probably the most noticeable sort of personal anecdote I can tell you is that you almost know within 3 weeks if this is going to work or not. You either have a patient who sort of muddles along and really nothing much changes, or suddenly they feel the best they've felt since being diagnosed with cancer. So it's almost like a Lazarus effect for some patients. Patients are almost rejuvenated. They regain their energy, their appetite. So when it really works, and we can see it very quickly, the improvements. What's more difficult is the patients who have sort of stable disease and it's not quite certain if they're responding or not. There are sometimes questions of pseudoprogression or even patients with stable disease who have late responses. So there is that group of patients as well. But when it works, boy, does it work. And it's amazing how long it works. On that trial now, I have patients, I had, I think, 6 patients with a partial response on that trial. And I think every single one of them had a duration of response greater than a year, most of them a year and a half, and some are now getting to 2 years. So it really changes sort of your conception, even though the chances of responding to these agents is unfortunately less than we had anticipated. When it does work, it works so well that one really has to consider that as part of when you choose your next line of therapy.
So, of course, we're seeing that story, obviously, in a lot of other cancers, and sort of a bunch of general questions always come up. You mentioned the prolonged responses that are so exciting. Have you had any patients where you stopped the therapy? I don't know what this particular trial called for.
2 years.
2 years.
So we're coming up on that for a few patients. I already have patients asking me, so what are we going to do? What's going to happen? Can I come off the study and pay for the drug myself? And, you know, I think the issue really is this is completely different than cell cycle poisons, and we really don't know if you really need 2 years. I mean, maybe you only need 3 months of therapy or 6 months of therapy. After all, the theory is that you're just upregulating the immune system and uncovering these cancers that are hiding, and does it really require ongoing therapy? And I think that that's a very important question. Particularly in these economic times, will need to be answered.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds weird, but I remember hearing that story coming out with breast cancer with tamoxifen and people, you know, not knowing. And they get out there and they're doing great and they don't mind getting treated. And of course, obviously a little different with this kind of a treatment, but similar. I have heard a number of cases in different cancers of people who had autoimmune complications that required them to stop therapy. So prematurely, a number of cases I've heard of, people did well.
Yeah. So I always tell the patients that when they have an autoimmune reaction, that they actually have a very high chance of responding. And often they respond after they come off treatment. And even they've been given high-dose steroids, which in theory is terrible for the immune system. But some people actually feel that there may be an advantage to giving steroids to these patients. But the bottom line is that patients who come off for autoimmune phenomenon can do very well and can have long durations of response. So I've seen this particularly with the nivolumab and ipilimumab combination, which obviously has a much higher rate of hospitalization than single agent PD-L1 inhibition. The CTLA-4 agents, or at least this one, is certainly more toxic. When you combine, you probably are getting some improvements in response rate and efficacy, but you pay for it. It's definitely, you pay for what you get.
And actually, I was going to ask you next about that, because the other person actually on this program, Dr. Jan Jigian, actually also presented at ASCO data on what you were just talking about. And this is a trial looking at nivolumab plus or minus ipilimumab. First, can you talk about what we know about nivolumab and, for that matter, other PD-1, PD-L1 agents? You talked about pembrolizumab.
Absolutely.
What you see in other cancers is kind of seem similar results. What do we know about single agent therapy? And maybe you can also talk about this trial looking at combination.
Sure. Well, the early data with pembrolizumab was the KEYNOTE-12 study, and the early data with nivolumab was the CheckMate 32 study. Basically, these were both exploratory trials that were conducted in multiple different cancers, and then single disease cohorts were presented. The first data was, again, with KEYNOTE-12 and pembrolizumab showing activity in gastric adenocarcinomas. Initially, they were talking about a 33% investigator-related response rate, and then when they went to central review, it was down to about 22-25%. They subsequently published in Lancet and showed, again, that clearly half of the patients had stable or better disease, a quarter of the patients had major responses, long duration of responses, and good progression-free and overall survival curves. CheckMate 32 in many ways was more interesting because it had a PD-1 inhibitor and also had a CTLA-4 inhibitor, looking at the combination. But I think that in many ways it was very interesting to look at the degree of PD-L1 positivity, the patients that were negative, the patients that were 1+, 5+, and looking at how this degree of positivity modulated the chances for response, but even the patients that were negative still had a chance of responding to therapy. So that was the early data with these two agents. Since then, the companies that make these agents have gone a little bit different routes. One was able to put forward a phase 3 study that has now been presented and published showing small, I think 1.15-month overall survival advantage, but also sort of a subgroup of patients that actually did quite well with improvements in 12-month disease-free survival, 12-month progression-free survival, and overall survival. So that study is the first study that shows in a randomized fashion a survival benefit for a checkpoint inhibitor in gastric cancer. The other route has been looking at a single, well, actually three arms, but one arm that was the registration study, looking at efficacy in third line, demonstrating a good response rate, improvement, a good progression-free survival, and overall survival. And that's the KEYNOTE-59 study that you had referred to earlier. Again, both studies, I think, clearly show that these agents are active. I think that they are not as active as we had hoped for, and perhaps not as active as in other diseases. I think that we're learning that we need to check all of our patients for MSI and PD-L1 so that we can strategize as to when we bring in immunotherapy. Is it an MSI high patient where we should be using immunotherapy early on, or is it a patient who's MSI stable and PD-L1 negative where we probably should be using ramucirumab and paclitaxel first and leaving immunotherapy for third line? So I think that we're beginning to understand sort of the fine details of how to use these agents, when to use them, what line of therapy to use them in. Both companies have ongoing studies. Probably most interesting to me is the adjuvant study. They've been willing to go in the adjuvant setting where they're giving patients the cross regimen that we talked about earlier, the neoadjuvant chemoradiation regimen for esophageal cancer, and then giving a year of nivolumab therapy for those patients who have residual disease on resection. That's a fascinating study to me, and I'm very hopeful that it'll be positive. On the other hand, there are a robust number of phase 3 studies in esophageal and gastric cancer that will clearly delineate its efficacy in the frontline setting, second line setting, and the third line setting. They've really covered all the bases. And gastric cancer, and particularly esophageal cancer, had been a hinterland for us oncologists for such a long time. Very frustrating, all the studies being conducted in the other major cancers. And now finally we're seeing interest, very good studies, very large definitive studies being performed finally in esophageal and gastric cancer.
You were talking about the issue of when to integrate it, how to use biomarkers before or after ramucirumab taxane, for example. And a question that comes up again, so many different cancers, well, not lung cancer anymore because now they're using it first line, but for example, bladder cancer, this discussion goes on, Hodgkin lymphoma, the discussion goes on, which is the older, very elderly patient who really isn't a candidate for chemotherapy. I don't know how often you see that with metastatic gastric, I assume pretty commonly. Would you like to give a checkpoint inhibitor to somebody particularly where you really don't want to give them chemo?
Yeah, and you certainly have patients who, on their own, are coming specifically for immunotherapy up front because they've had some relative or a parent who's had a horrible experience with chemotherapy, and many of them are eager to avoid chemotherapy at all costs. I would caution those people, though, that monotherapy in MSI stable PD-L1 negative groups, the response rate and the chances for response are so low that I probably would favor a mild chemotherapy instead. A weekly taxane by itself or with ramucirumab, capecitabine, single agent, single conventional chemotherapy is more likely to be efficacious and probably not more toxic.
So you also brought up, which to my assessment is probably the most asked question and issue right now in GI cancers in general, and cancer in general, I think, really is a major, major issue, which is this MSI story. And now with an FDA approval based on the marker and not the tumor.
Yes.
So first of all, I'm curious how you're approaching MSI testing at Dana-Farber. I've heard of centers where they're now testing everybody with GI cancers of any type for MSI. I mean, it's only a biomarker, but I guess you have to take into consideration the cost when it's such a low. I think in breast cancer, it's like 0.01% or whatever, but, you know, so efficacious. How are you approaching the issue of MSI testing, and what's the overlap between MSI and gastric cancer? Initially, I was hearing, well, a quarter of gastric cancer is MSI high. Then I was hearing, well, that's a quarter up front. It's actually only 5% metastatic disease. So how does this all come together with really one of the biggest stories in oncology right now?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. It is a huge story in cancers that typically have a poor chance of responding, and we suddenly have something that works remarkably well and has little toxicity. But to get back to your initial question, how do we do this at the Farber? Well, based on data that is unique to colorectal cancer, and again, that's looking for Lynch syndrome and the unique properties of colorectal cancer, we test all of our patients for MSI with colorectal cancer. We have talked extensively about doing it for other GI malignancies, and at this point, as a group, we haven't been willing to do this yet automatically for our patients, partly because we have something called OncoPanel, which is a version of the Foundation One testing. So actually the investigators or scientists at Dana-Farber were the originators of Foundation One, and our OncoPanel is generally one generation ahead of what Foundation One has. But that includes MSI. Since we have a commitment to our patients that everybody gets OncoPanel testing, we eventually do get that data. It usually takes us about 2 months to get that back. And since we really haven't made a commitment yet to using immunotherapy in the frontline setting yet for our patients, that 2-month turnover is acceptable to us at the current time. So at our institution, all of the colorectal cancer patients get MSI testing up front. The other patients get it through OncoPanel, and then we generally like to confirm it through immunohistochemistry. In some patients where there's some urgency, we will send the tissue blocks for MSI testing by IHC. But as I said, since the role of checkpoint inhibitors in MSI is currently second, third line, we feel comfortable right now not testing up front as yet.
Although, again, with that high response rate, and you think about a patient who presents with, you know, out visceral disease, who's not in crisis,
but it's, MSI. In most of the GI malignancies, it's 2-3% of the population. So you got to kiss a lot of frogs before you get your prince.
Well, what is the story, though, with gastric cancer? Again, originally I was thinking, well, maybe it's the MSI patients who are responding. And then, you know, I hear the story that, well, actually in metastatic disease, you don't see that much MSI. It sounds like colon in a way.
Yeah. So we looked at that, and was it, in fact, in Keynote 59, the MSI patients that were driving this? And really, it's not. So there are clearly patients who are MSI stable who respond to pembrolizumab. And yes, there is a higher chance of responding, but the numbers are so small that I think it was that there were only, is it 8 patients in Keynote 59 that were MSI high? It's a very small number. It may even be half of that. I forget. But the number that I now remember is about 3% of metastatic gastric cancer patients are MSI high. So I think that we have to be very careful about telling our patients about this up front. the chances that this is not going to work out for them is extremely high. And I think it's better sort of to leave it as a wonderful discovery down the line rather than saying, you know, hey, you've been diagnosed with gastric cancer, let's check for MSI and you have a 3 out of 100 chance of benefiting from this.
How are you sequencing checkpoint inhibition into your metastatic disease algorithm?
So I would prefer sticking with the current data, which is in patients who have had platinum and 5-FU and who have also received a taxane with or without ramucirumab. But I do, as I said, test for PD-L1 and MSI in my patients. And if somebody comes back strongly positive for PD-L1 or is MSI high, I will move up the checkpoint inhibitor into second line. And again, the patients I see, it's not unusual for them to ask for this to be done up front. So, you know, the world we live in is patients are consumers and they've heard of this and they know to ask.
So right now, pembrolizumab is approved. What about nivolumab?
I think that it's just pembro at this point, and the question is if nivolumab is going to get approval based on East Asian data, which would be a first since there were no American or European patients included in the trial.
At this point, what's your assessment in terms of the relative efficacy, at least of those two agents?
I don't know for sure, but I think that probably the two agents are of fairly similar efficacy. I think nivolumab and pembrolizumab probably have similar efficacy.
I want to actually just talk about a few papers. And one that we found that you wrote, a journal I don't usually read, Diseases of the Esophagus, and I guess it was just published in the last month, a retrospective comparison of neoadjuvant chemotherapy regimens for locally advanced esophageal cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what you were trying to get across in that paper and what you think are some of the key clinical issues in this particular issue?
Well, I think that, again, there have been a variety of neoadjuvant regimens that have been used with or without radiation therapy for esophageal cancer. And I think that there are a number of issues that need to be considered with these regimens, particularly toxicity, efficacy, as well as the ability for patients then to move on to surgery, which is ultimately the goal for most of these patients. So we have over the years been experimenting with various regimens to see which ones can achieve the highest response rates, which have the least toxicity, and ultimately which ones we feel we should move forward with. Ultimately, we found that the cross regimen is really quite well tolerated, and it has become our standard since the publication in the New England Journal of Medicine now several years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago now. And we found that really compared to older regimens that we had used, that there was improved efficacy, decreased toxicity. And I think that I'm not alone in really coming to the conclusion that although weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin is perhaps not as sexy as some of the other regimens that others have proposed, it really offers a nice balance between the ability to shrink the cancer, to achieve partial responses and even CRs, but also to get the patient to surgery. And we've really seen a much higher rate of patients being able to get to surgery than with many of the other regimens. So I think that it's really the total package that this cross regimen, this weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin, has provided for all of us.
So another paper slash topic I wanted to ask you about is you've written a lot about novel agents that are being investigated in gastric cancer, and it's kind of a little bit hard to find anything super exciting outside the checkpoint inhibitors, but I was curious about this so-called anti-claudin antibody because that kind of seems a little bit cool and promising. There was a paper in the Journal of Hematologic Oncology in May reviewing this, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know about this agent.
Sure. Well, the study known as FAST was presented by Salah Albatran at ASCO now more than a year ago, ASCO 2016. I was the discussant at that session. And basically, the study was quite exciting. It showed that this agent, IMAB362, could significantly improve progression-free survival and overall survival in patients that expressed claudin 18.2. And claudin 18.2 is a molecule that is partially responsible for the tight junctions that occur between cells. There are a variety of theories on how this particular antibody works. The thought is that it binds to this molecule and ultimately leads to some cell disintegration, and that this ultimately then stimulates a ADCC reaction and also a CDC reaction. So they're postulating a variety of mechanisms in which this particular antibody works. I think ultimately we truly don't fully understand what is going on here. I know that we would like to, but I think that in many ways this is still a project in process. But the bottom line is that it had a very impressive randomized phase two result, almost doubling in progression-free survival and overall survival, and in fact an enhanced effect in patients that were high claudin expressors. So I think that it clearly provided the data to move on to a large randomized phase three study.
I mean, I kind of think of things in kind of basic ways, probably not that accurate scientifically, but when you think about this in your mind, do you think about something like trastuzumab against anti-HER, or is that sort of the model?
So again, we actually have looked at data with trastuzumab, and I think that although it's thought to work through the HER2 pathway, and we actually have some very interesting data from one of our studies looking at pre-treatment biopsies and post-treatment biopsies. And there is actually a lot of evidence to suggest that it may actually work through immune activity. So
right.
It may be a poor man's checkpoint inhibitor or immunomodulating agent. I think that a lot of these antibodies may actually work in the same way. They latch on to some aspect of the cancer cell and somehow allow the immune system to realize that there's a foreign agent or a foreign body there, and then activate some sort of an immune process. So I think that a lot of these agents that supposedly work through one pathway or another may ultimately be found to be immunomodulating agents.
Again, sort of keeping it at a med student level, which I feel like it's even hard for me to be nowadays, again, sort of conceptualize it and think about it in terms of sort of antibody therapy. I mean, do you think rituximab is in the same ballpark?
I do. I think that cetuximab certainly could have similar efficacy or similar pathway. I mean, there is data, I mean, much better data with cetuximab to suggest that it works through RAS and that particular pathway. But the company that makes cetuximab has from the beginning talked about an ADCC activity, and I suspect that that is at least part of its activity.
So speaking of new agents in phase three, you know, the last couple of years we've been talking with hopeful optimism about the strategy of what's been called anti-stem cell therapy. And specifically, there's an agent out there, napobucosin, which I was trying to get excited about. And now I see maybe I shouldn't get excited about because the so-called BRIGHTER trial, and we've seen a press release. What is napobucosin and what do we know at this point and where's it heading?
Yeah, BBI, what is it, 608. Is an agent that is supposed to affect stemness. And, you know, I think I must applaud the, the company. You know, it's probably the most novel sort of pathway or the most novel way in which we're theoretically attacking these cells. And, you know, I think the idea of targeting some sort of a stem cell that's quiescent and doesn't respond well to cell cycle poisons is a very, very ideal way in targeting cancer. I think ultimately, again, it's the question of if that's really how this drug works and if it really does work. There's a variety of stemness pathways. It's STAT3, WNT, and I mean, there's a whole host of pathways that seem to be involved in this. And, you know, I think that I was, for instance, disappointed in the colorectal data that was generated with this drug as well. So I think that if I were to handicap some of these ongoing phase three studies based on the colorectal data and the fact that stemness should probably be very similar between colorectal cancer and gastric cancer, I probably wouldn't handicap this drug very highly. But it's clearly, it's an interesting mechanism, and if we could somehow target this, I think that potentially this would be a very important pathway. So I think that we'll see. We have a robust phase three study. It's, I think, a reasonable design of paclitaxel with or without BBI 608. And, you know, we'll see if it's positive or not. But I think that, as you pointed out, some of the preliminary data is a little worrisome.
So let's go through some of your cases, beginning with your 72-year-old man.
Okay, absolutely. So let me tell you about this gentleman, very nice man, recently retired, an administrator in a local educational system, a gentleman who presented with metastatic gastric cancer up front. He had a mass in the cardia. He had multiple liver lesions, several significantly enlarged lymph nodes, clearly was unresectable up front. And our standard frontline treatment for metastatic gastric cancer is the FOLFOX regimen. At the time, we had an interesting trial that looked at FOLFOX with or without zivaflibercept, which is an angiogenesis inhibitor. And this randomized phase 2 study was placebo-controlled, double-blinded, and the gentleman enrolled in this study and did remarkably well. In the end, it turned out that he was randomized to the placebo arm and had done remarkably well on FOLFOX, which is, frankly, not unusual. Patients do fabulously well on this regimen. Generally, what I do is I have them on FOLFOX until they develop bridging neuropathy, and then I keep them on the modified de Grammont regimen for months and years in some cases. Eventually, he did progress, though, and we ultimately switched him to paclitaxel and ramucirumab, because by the time that he actually had progressed, his peripheral neuropathy had resolved, and he was once again able to receive this combination, again had a great response, and then after about a year or so, had progressive disease.
Before you go on, I'm kind of curious what you would have done if he still had significant neuropathy at that point.
That's interesting, because if you look at the textbooks or the trials, you know, you have either grade 3 neuropathy or you don't. In most cases, patients tell you, well, I still have some neuropathy. Does it go away? No. Does it bother you? Not really. It bothers me at certain times. So the neuropathy that I deal with typically in my practice is not sort of this debilitating neuropathy. It's a persistent neuropathy. And frankly, my experience is that even when they have sort of grade 1, grade 2 neuropathy, starting up paclitaxel or ramucirumab doesn't really worsen it. It certainly doesn't get better, but it's certainly not sort of a sudden dramatic worsening in neuropathy. My experience is that it sort of just continues on, and generally the patient progresses or comes off therapy for other reasons before this becomes an issue. So the fact that some people say, well, you know, if you have peripheral neuropathy, you should just use ramucirumab by itself. Really, I haven't seen that in my practice because I frankly haven't seen a worsening in neuropathy when I use the combination after FOLFOX.
Would you combine ramucirumab with another chemotherapeutic agent?
I'm hesitant to do so, in fact, because I've not had a problem with the neuropathy with paclitaxel. I know that others have combined it with irinotecan or switch out docetaxel for paclitaxel or have given it with a variety of other agents. I've been hesitant to do so. And again, partly because I'm hampered by our system where we have pathways, we have computer builds. So I'm more tied to where the data is than, say, somebody out in private practice.
So we'll talk about what happened to this man at that point, but just to pick out a little bit there, though, on the ramucirumab, because you mentioned he was on this trial looking at zivaflibercept, another anti-angiogenic. I remember there were actually trials, I think, of bevacizumab in gastric. Obviously, it wasn't very promising because it never came into practice, and yet ramucirumab, like this patient, is now really become a standard. Can you talk about, in general, what the clinical research data has shown with using these various anti-angiogenic strategies, Bev, aflibercept, regorafenib, apatinib is another one, and regorafenib, and sort of why it is that we landed in the ramucirumab?
Absolutely. Well, I think we all know that the age of angiogenesis inhibition started with bevacizumab, and after the initial successes in colorectal cancer and lung cancer and to a certain degree in breast cancer, they decided to test this agent with standard therapy in gastric cancer. And the study known as AVAGAST combined standard platinum 5-FU therapy with or without their agent bevacizumab. So they showed a significant improvement in response rate, progression-free survival, and even showed a 2-month improvement in overall survival, but it was just not statistically significant. And in the end, I think that they were undone by the fact that the Japanese and the other East Asians were using multiple lines of therapy after this frontline treatment, and that really the response rate, progression-free survival could not be pulled through due to the sort of mediating effects of second and even third line therapy for these patients that were primarily from Asia. And this has ultimately led to the effect that a lot of pharmaceutical companies limit the number of patients on their trials that come from East Asia, at least in this particular arena, so that no more than 25 or 30% of patients are allowed to come from China and Japan. And I think that really we have learned from this experience that in gastric cancer, we're no longer talking about one line of therapy. We're talking about a disease that can receive two lines and now three lines of therapy with the checkpoint inhibitors. So unfortunately, the company was not willing to sort of redo the study with the appropriate modifications. And I think that's where ramucirumab took advantage of this particular hole and in many ways does have some advantages over bevacizumab and tested first as a single agent versus best supportive care in cisplatin 5-FU refractory disease and then in combination with paclitaxel. And I think that clearly there was an advantage of using this agent in second and even third line because I do believe that there is some sort of way in which cancer cells become angiogenesis dependent. And when you stop an angiogenesis inhibitor, I think that it's not necessarily the further inhibition. It's sort of the fact that you're withdrawing this agent. And I think, for instance, in colorectal cancer, I don't think that necessarily giving further bevacizumab or ramucirumab, it's the efficacy of the drug. I think that actually when you withdraw it, the patients actually do worse. And I think that that was really the advantage that ramucirumab had in the second and third line setting. That being said, now the early data with the RAINFALL study with ramucirumab, where they're reporting progression-free survival advantage for that study, I think is promising that ramucirumab will probably get a frontline indication with cisplatin and 5-FU.
Can you review the design of that study and what we've seen from it?
Certainly. That was a study that was completed in January or February of this year. And now they've reported progression-free survival data have met this primary endpoint. It was a study that looked at cisplatin 5-FU with or without ramucirumab. And the patients who have received ramucirumab have a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. And the progression-free survival advantage is such that it is highly unlikely that the overall survival advantage will not be statistically significant. So the thought is that it is very likely that there will be an OS advantage with ramucirumab and that we will see FDA approval for this agent now in all lines of therapy. The big question, of course, is do you continue ramucirumab in multiple lines of therapy? And with other agents showing efficacy in this disease, where do you use ramucirumab? Do you use it up front, second line? And I think that things are finally getting interesting in this disease where we have multiple competing drugs that are actually efficacious.
But I guess, I mean, again, in the second line setting, quote, there's no maintenance, but I imagine there are people who get neuropathy where you drop the paclitaxel.
So oh, absolutely, yeah.
It kind of works out like it really is maintenance anyhow.
That's right.
But you give it until progression.
Correct.
Right. So that is interesting, and we'll see whether that plays out. It was interesting. I referred to your, quote, colleague, Charlie Fuchs, and of course, he did a lot of the work on ramucirumab, but he's not your colleague anymore, so he's gone now.
Things. Well, he's now the director of the Yale Cancer Center.
So he got stolen by the Mets, you know, or whatever. Anyhow.
He's actually a Yankees fan.
Oh, he's a Yankee?
Be careful about that.
Anyhow, so let's continue on with this patient because I think the next thing that happened was really fascinating. So he gets the paclitaxel ramucirumab, as you say, he does well for about a year, and he actually had a partial response. And then what happened?
Well, unfortunately, as these things go, I mean, he eventually progressed. And, you know, I think it was not unexpected. When you look at the RAINBOW study, it's really an amazing overall survival. I mean, but ultimately all of these patients progress, and this gentleman did progress as well, and we ultimately put him on a study of pembrolizumab.
And what happened?
Well, he felt better, in fact, quite a bit better, but his first CAT scan showed a 180% progression.
Where did he have disease?
He had disease mostly in the lymph nodes, but also in the liver. And what worried us was that it wasn't just the lymph nodes that had increased in size, but also the liver.
But yet, clinically, he was feeling better.
He was feeling better. Not a lot better. That was also the concern. Slightly better.
But definitely not worse.
definitely not worse. So we took a chance and we actually continued him on therapy. And his most recent scan about 2 weeks ago shows, instead of 180% progression, shows a 97% progression. So he's gotten half of that back again. So he's not yet at a major response, but he's heading in the right direction.
When you say 97%, are you saying...
From baseline.
So does that mean he's about the same as baseline?
No.
He's double.
He went from baseline to 180% progression.
But 180% means more than double.
Yes.
Okay.
Almost quadrupling.
Right.
And now he's 97% worse than baseline. So he's heading back in the right direction.
So it sounds like he's maybe having something that supposedly never happens or almost never happens, which is pseudo-progression. Is that your thinking?
Yeah, so I think that as these things go, a lot of people bandy about pseudoprogression and how, you know, is it pseudoprogression? And the reality is that it's much less common than we would hope or we would think. Our best estimate is that it's probably around 5% and perhaps even less in esophageal and gastric cancer. I think that particularly in KEYNOTE-59, there were virtually no patients who had pseudoprogression. So I think that we'll have to see how this pans out. But the bottom line, it's palliative therapy. And if the man is feeling better and his disease is heading in the right direction, who am I to discontinue him off something that offers an improvement in quality of life and is actually keeping his cancer from growing?
So note to myself, I'm going to keep in contact with you and find out what happens.
That's right. Hopefully it'll continue to be a positive story.
Well, that'll be cool if he actually turns into having a response. And you know, it's funny. Of course, we first started hearing about checkpoint inhibitors from the melanoma people. And, you know, they were obviously the first people to bring up this issue of pseudoprogression. And what they started to say was, if the patient feels fine, in general, keep going. And then we started to hear other specialties saying the same thing. And I guess it sort of is intuitively logical to do that.
I think you basically have to throw out everything you've learned about oncology. I think that we're having difficulty understanding exactly how to count a response or a win with these new agents. I heard recently at a meeting of a patient who had no response to one of the checkpoint inhibitors and after 12 cycles suddenly had a PR. So, you know, I think that it ultimately really comes down to the fact that if you're forced to stop, you're forced to stop. I mean, if the patient's going down the tubes and you still have another agent that you can use, then you got to salvage them. But if they seem to be doing okay and there's not significant progression of disease, I think that waiting it out is certainly reasonable, particularly since just coming off of chemotherapy makes a lot of the patients feel better. So again, I think we forget that we're not treating a CAT scan, we're treating a patient. And quality of life, although we've traditionally had difficulty measuring this in clinical trials, is ultimately why we treat patients. It's to improve quality of life as well as to prolong life. And if that is what's working, then why not continue it?
We'll see what happens with this patient, but really interesting situation. I want to hear about your 53-year-old man, and actually it kind of sounds like he went down sort of a similar course in getting actually on the same trial. So FOLFOX plus or minus aflibercept until disease progression. Was he on placebo or treatment?
He was also on placebo,
okay.
Yeah.
So then he also got paclitaxel ramucirumab. Did he respond to that, incidentally?
Also responded well. Not in the sense that he had a PR, but he literally had a minor response and then maintained that for a year and a half.
So the thing I want to ask you about him, because so far, then he gets pembrolizumab and was on it for a year and a half, so that sounds pretty good. The thing I want to ask you about, and I've kind of heard a few cases of this, but it wasn't really in the initial thing, you know, when we start hearing about autoimmune toxicity. I don't remember hearing much about type 1 diabetes, although you certainly wouldn't be surprised. And now I've kind of been hearing a few cases, and I see that's what happened to this patient.
Absolutely. So I think that we're using these agents enough that we're beginning to see all of the rare reactions. I mean, recently we had to reissue all of our consent forms for Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Traditionally, when I was first using these agents, particularly with nivolumab and ipilimumab, we were seeing pneumonitis. It was pneumonitis and colitis that was primarily what was getting these patients into trouble. But since then, we've been seeing all sorts of different things, partly also because we're getting more and more liberal with using these agents. For instance, there's now data showing that, you know, in certain cases, you can use these with patients who have rheumatoid arthritis. And when they start getting a flare of the rheumatoid arthritis, you have to back off off these agents. But we're seeing all sorts of problems, like this patient who literally, in the last few weeks of being on pembrolizumab, his blood glucose started going up into the hundreds, then in the 200s, and then really where he presented one day to me with a blood glucose of 500, a gentleman who was thin, otherwise no family history of diabetes, and suddenly, you know, I have to put him on an insulin drip to get his disease under control. An emergency endocrinology consult. How often do you get those, right? But absolutely. And I think one of the things that when consenting patients, I'd always been saying, oh, you know, these drugs have virtually no side effects. You don't have to worry about this. There's some rare autoimmune phenomenon. But I think we're seeing particularly thyroiditis. There's a lot of that occurring. Fortunately, it's not that dangerous, but you certainly see hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism. And I think that, for instance, in Keynote 59, I think 17% of patients had some form of autoimmune syndrome, even though it was typically mild. So I think that we're going to have to learn how to treat these. And for instance, at our institution, we already have a service that focuses on immunomodulatory related autoimmune phenomenon. So this is a service that specializes in autoimmune disease that is secondary to our treatments.
What kind of docs do you have on the service?
Rheumatologists and infectious disease specialists, primarily the rheumatologists and the endocrinologists.
Interesting. And like, for example, when you see a patient with diarrhea, you're thinking about colitis, you send it to them?
Well, they get the patient if it's severe enough to be hospitalized.
That's really interesting.
But we definitely have some of the members from rheumatology and endocrinology already specializing in this and see it as an opportunity to build their own research practice.
So let's hear about your 58-year-old man.
Sure. This gentleman, a really nice guy, you know, sort of the guy is like Mike Ditka kind of a guy, right? You know, loves his pretzels and beer and really is just a really down-to-earth guy, no nonsense, never complains. This guy had presented with HER2-positive GE junction cancer. And at the time, we were running a study in which we were giving oxaliplatin, capecitabine, bevacizumab, and trastuzumab. And the reason for that was that there was this great preclinical data suggesting synergy between these two pathways. There's several preclinical studies looking at LD50s and looking at xenografts, and there's a lot of data suggesting that these pathways can be synergistic. And we moved forward with this idea and ultimately treated 36 patients with this combination. And as the studies that we've talked about so far, like Avagast, has a 46% response rate. The TOGA study, which is the trial that got trastuzumab approved for gastric cancer, has a, I think, a 46% response rate. This study had an 81% response rate. Virtually every patient responded to this treatment. And the only patients, in retrospect, that we found that didn't respond had MET mutations and ultimately responded to MET inhibitors. But really, almost every patient responded to this treatment, and the duration of response was incredible. We had a progression-free survival of about a year, overall survival of more than 2 years. The study has taken so long because up until recently, I still had a third of the patients on the study. So we're now finally, or unfortunately, getting to the point where we have enough progressors that we're going to publish this. But there clearly is something to this combination that I think needs to be explored further.
It's interesting because I think I remember hearing about this in breast cancer. My recollection was it sort of crashed.
Well, you know, that just goes to show you that, well, we know that something that works in breast cancer doesn't necessarily work in gastric cancer, so why not the reverse? But as I said, this has been remarkable, and I'm hopeful that we can confirm these results in a phase 3 study.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, Bev has some toxicity, but not necessarily the worst thing in the world.
No.
Is this something you do or would do outside a trial setting?
I would if I could get it reimbursed by the insurance companies. If I could, I would definitely do it. I would give this as my standard frontline treatment for HER2-positive patients. I think that what we found was very little toxicity, and ultimately, the responses and duration of responses are so dramatic that I can't see this as being a fluke of just us treating the patients. This was a multi-center study from 4 academic centers. It was blinded. We had a tumor metrics core that was blinded to the agents. It was one patient I remember, 29% response rate. They wouldn't give it to me. So It was a rigorous, centrally reviewed study response.
That's really fascinating. You know, it's amazing how many people I interview about gastric cancer. I've never heard that.
We presented it at ASCO, I think, about 4 years ago.
Oh, that's interesting.
It was a poster discussion, I think.
Interesting.
Yes, and Ian Chow was actually the one who discussed it.
So yeah. In any event, so he was on this for 5 years?
Yes.
Wow. And did well, no toxicity issues?
No toxicity. Now, I will say what we did in part to be able to continue patients for this length of time is we would drop agents as needed. So you'd come off the oxaliplatin usually within the first several months. Some of the patients ended up having low LVEF, so we had to drop the trastuzumab. Others had thrombosis, so we would drop the bevacizumab. So this study allowed the various agents to be dropped as needed, but as long as the disease was kept from growing, they were allowed to continue on the study.
And so with him, he was on it for 5 years. How long did he?
In the last year and a half, he was just on bevacizumab and trastuzumab.
Interesting, interesting. So you stopped the 5-FU also?
Yes, we had to because he had low platelets. I think we burned out his marrow over a 4-year course.
Amazing. So then you faced the challenging issue of second-line therapy in this patient who did great. A very controversial situation because all the general oncologists who treat breast cancer, they just want to keep trastuzumab going and give chemotherapy, but you also have the issue of ramucirumab. There are some people who try to combine all three, although most people don't do that, but it really is a vexing problem. And I know he went on a trial, but I am curious before you talk about the trial that he went on, what you would do in general or how you handle this or what you would have done with him outside a trial. Do you ever keep trastuzumab? Well, in this case, he's on Bev too, going and, you know, give different chemo or T-DM1.
So you're absolutely right. This was the problem, was that this was a gentleman who had problems with counts. And so what do you give? What conventional agent do you give? You've already exposed him to an angiogenesis inhibitor. You've already exposed him to trastuzumab. And that's why I was really so excited that we could get him on our clinical trial. But the answer to would I use standardly for this person, clearly I would give him a checkpoint inhibitor next because that's the one that he would be most likely to tolerate.
So why not paclitaxel ramucirumab?
Because his platelets were too low.
Interesting.
So he had trouble with his platelets, and this is why he came off the capecitabine. And I should point out that this is a gentleman we're sustaining his platelets with N-plate to keep the platelets up.
But in general, how do you approach second-line therapy? Do you ever keep the trastuzumab going? Do you go with paclitaxel ramucirumab? Would you use trastuzumab paclitaxel ramucirumab?
So the answer is I have never continued trastuzumab in second and subsequent lines of therapy, in part because at our institution I have to show data and prove the benefit or efficacy, and there really is no good data. I think there was a recent publication that offers some evidence, but the bottom line is that unlike breast cancer, where they actually have the data now, we really don't have it in gastric cancer. And I think that up until recently, we've been trying to sort of keep ourselves going by participating in trials like the Gatsby study. And now, for instance, this study looking at a variety of companies are producing sort of second line anti-HER2 agents. And I think that that's probably where we should be going rather than trying to continue trastuzumab into subsequent lines of therapy.
So this patient goes on a trial of pembrolizumab and margetuximab. What is that, incidentally?
It's an Fc-optimized antibody to HER2. And what the company says is that the drug seems to produce a greater ADCC activity than does trastuzumab. They have a phase one study where they gave this agent margetuximab to patients with trastuzumab refractory disease. I believe they had like 4 out of 19 partial responses, and I think the majority of patients actually had some sort of a response. So based on the preclinical data and on this phase one study, they're moving forward and looking at trastuzumab refractory disease in both breast and gastric cancer.
So how did he do on this therapy?
He just started it. So we've been participating in this trial, but he has just started it. So I wish I could tell you, I wish I had some exciting news, but stay tuned.
But it's interesting, though, thinking back to your comments earlier about the mechanism of action monoclonal antibodies, combining this monoclonal antibody with a checkpoint inhibitor kind of lines up with what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, there's obviously some very promising preclinical data. There's some wonderful theoretical data or theoretical concepts that need to be proven here. But, you know, I think that this is something that definitely needs to be explored.
So let's talk a little bit about second-line therapy of metastatic disease.
So, you know, I think that for the longest period of time, it was unclear if there was a second-line therapy benefit in gastric and, for that matter, in esophageal cancer. People would argue this, and frankly, you know, randomized studies in Europe and elsewhere, patients would get one line of therapy and then would move on to hospice. So I think the East Asians felt a little bit differently about this, but all of this more or less changed with the presentation and then publication of the Cougar II study, which was ultimately published in Lancet Oncology in 2014. Basically, this study took patients with metastatic gastric cancer that had progressed on cisplatin and 5-FU and randomized them to paclitaxel versus best supportive care. The study showed a small but statistically significant survival advantage, 3.6 months for best supportive care versus 5.2 months for docetaxel. And really, this confirmed for many of us who believed in second-line therapy for this disease that there clearly was an advantage to giving some therapy beyond frontline treatment. Very soon thereafter, Charlie Fuchs presented and then published data from the REGARD study. They, at the time, had been looking at using ramucirumab in this particular setting, and it also looked at patients with cisplatin and 5-FU refractory disease. At the time, there was no proof of second-line therapy, so they felt very comfortable using placebo as a control. So patients were randomized to placebo versus ramucirumab, and ultimately, this study proved to be positive with a statistically significant benefit for patients on the ramucirumab arm. These patients notably had very little toxicity. And in fact, I always like telling people, when you look at the toxicity tables on this particular study, there was less toxicity on the ramucirumab arm than on the placebo arm. But when you looked at progression-free survival and overall survival, even though the difference in median overall survival was not that great, there were nice improvements in 6-month overall survival, 12-month overall survival, about 10% and 7% respectively. And again, people say, well, you know, this agent isn't that active, but on the other hand, it's not very toxic. So I think that it does certainly have its use, particularly when you go to the next study, the RAINBOW study, which now combines these two positive studies. You now combine Cougar and you combine REGARD and you get RAINBOW, where now in this study, patients again with platinum and 5-FU refractory disease are randomized either to a taxane or to a taxane plus ramucirumab. And again, the paclitaxel arm has a survival that's actually similar, if not better, than what we see in Cougar II. But the ramucirumab arm, where the combination, is even better, a 2.3-month improvement in median survival, a nice 10% improvement in overall survival. And sort of building on Cougar and building on REGARD, I think that RAINBOW clearly has demonstrated the new second-line standard of care. And really, this is what I give to all of my patients as long as they've got a reasonable performance status. Fortunately, we're able now to move beyond second-line therapy. I think the checkpoint inhibitors are now going to move us into having a viable third-line option. The first data that we saw with checkpoint inhibition in gastric cancer was the KEYNOTE-12 study. This trial used an outdated dose and schedule of pembrolizumab, but ultimately in melanoma, we've seen that the standard straight 200 milligram dose is just as efficacious, and I think that we can translate this data to the currently FDA-approved doses. But what we saw in KEYNOTE is that there's clearly a benefit for a subgroup of patients. Half of the patients had stable or better disease, but more importantly, about a quarter of the patients had a major response, and everybody who had a major response, almost everybody, had a response duration that was greater than 6 months, extending into a year, year and a half. And progression-free and overall survival were quite nice in this study. When you look at a median overall survival, 11.4 months, you can argue, well, this is a very select group of patients. But on the other hand, this really beats what we would see certainly with best supportive care. So I think clearly a viable third-line option that's further supported now with the ONO 4538 study This is a study from Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, looking at patients with multiply refractory gastric cancer and treating them with nivolumab versus best supportive care in the standard nivolumab dose. They showed a small but statistically significant improvement in overall survival, 4.14 months with placebo versus 5.32 months overall survival. Really a very small improvement in progression-free survival, but still statistically significant. You see that most of the patients don't respond to this agent, and then you see a subgroup where there's a nice separation of the curves. There's clearly a subgroup of patients with refractory disease that respond to checkpoint inhibitors and for a durable amount of time. So I think now in this 2017, we now have three good clear lines of therapy for this disease. And I think there's a chance with some ongoing studies that we could have even more lines of therapy for gastric cancer, really moving from only one line of therapy now to three effective lines of therapy is really a huge advance for this very refractory, aggressive cancer.